Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Saintly Role Models. Pope Benedict looks at the examples of holiness shown by several saints from this week's liturgical calendar at his Wednesday General Audience. Migrant Viewpoint. As the debate continues over how to reform the US's immigration system, we speak to a Mexican migrant and an American priest to find out why the issue is so divisive. And Dying with Dignity. We discover why it's time to banish that image of the hospice as a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the examples of holiness displayed by several saints celebrated in this week's liturgical calendar. Emma McCarthy reports.
The second general audience to be held in Castel Gandolfo since Pope Benedict's return from vacation was dedicated to saints and, more specifically, what we can learn from them.
I cordially greet all the English-speaking pilgrims present to this audience. I particularly welcome the altar servers from Malta, along with their families, who have been assisting at St. Peter's Basilica. I also greet a group of university students from Ireland.
Speaking to a group of roughly 4,000 pilgrims in the courtyard of the Apostolic Residence, he said that we should take advantage of summer to perfect our knowledge of the lives of the saints. Then the Pope gave the groups also from Spain, India, the US and Russia a practical example of just where to begin in this quest, the liturgical calendar.
This week, the liturgical calendar celebrates several remarkable examples of holiness. St. John Eudes, St. Bernardo Clairvaux, St. Pius X, and St. Rose of Lima. The summer months provide an opportunity for us to read about the lives of these and all the saints, who show us that holiness is not the privilege of a few, but the vocation of all the baptized.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict added that day after day the Church offers us the opportunity to walk in the company of saints. Quoting from theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar, he said saints give us the best commentary on the gospel because they show us how to put it into practice. He then suggested that while the holiday season is an ideal time to take up the biography or perhaps writings of one particular saint, we should in fact try each and every day to at least familiarize ourselves with others. Their human and spiritual experience, he continued, shows us that sainthood is not a luxury or privilege of the few, but offered to everyone. The Pope also pointed out that men and women of extraordinary charisma do not necessarily make great saints, that more often than not, there are many thousands of saints whose names are known only to God, because here on earth they have led an apparently normal life. In fact, concluded Pope Benedict, these normal saints are those loved by God.
Through the intercession and inspiration, may you learn to love and serve the Lord more ardently in your daily lives. God bless you all.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Most Americans know that there are 12 million undocumented immigrants in the US, but the ongoing debate over how to reform the current immigration system has divided the country. When passions run deep on such an emotive issue, it helps explain why various attempts in Congress to pass a comprehensive reform of the US's immigration laws have floundered in recent years. At a recent national conference on immigration sponsored by the U.S. Catholic bishops, a leading American cardinal called for fairer and more humane immigration policies. Other church officials said overcoming ignorance and misconceptions is a key element in the fight for justice regarding immigration issues. Looking back at the history of America, it was the successive waves of immigrants from many different countries who helped provide the foundation on which the U.S. was built. This was a key point spelt out by Pope Benedict during his trip to the U.S. in April 2008. He not only reminded Americans of their nation's history in this regard, but also of their duty to be kind to immigrants, as the nation had been in the past. But as the debate over immigration continues, there is no sign of a let-up in the number of migrants, mostly from Mexico and Latin America, who seek to come and work in the world's richest country, even though up to 500 die each year in the attempt. But how do these migrants view their host country? And what kind of living and working conditions await them there? Lupita Sanchez is the daughter of Mexican migrants who lives in the Texan city of Brownsville, just over the border from Mexico. She says the climate has become far more hostile of late, with growing intolerance and harassment by the American authorities. Me miraron con despejo,
sin amor. I have hope that the next government will do more things in the immigration issue. I would like to see less conspiracy about Latin Americans. We've seen it more often now, and I don't think people should be judged or seen as an enemy just because they're trying to look for a better place to live and for the betterment of their families.
Do you feel that as Hispanics living in Texas, do you come across hostility because of your ethnic background?
Yeah. Like I said, I've seen it before, but we're starting to see it more often now. They say it's homeland security. If somebody is being stopped and it's not legally in the United States and you don't have an ID, for example, they will call the immigration, and we didn't see this before. For me, that's an aggravation. For me, that's a violence. They're not respecting people anymore. And it shows they're willing to do anything to keep these people away from the states.
Now, when it comes to the role of the Catholic Church in providing help and support to immigrants, how important is that role? How helpful are they being, in fact?
The Church is working as much as they can to prevent many issues that the community has in many ways, like I say, not only in the immigration area, but in the health area too. We, especially in this community, we have felt very good the support of the church.
Lupita's testimony is echoed by Father Michael Seifert, a Catholic priest who also lives in Brownsville and who has been at the forefront of efforts to improve the plight of Mexican migrants living in that area. He says despite many strident voices in the U.S. warning about the threat posed by illegal migrants, most Americans favor a reform of the current immigration laws.
The majority of Americans, contrary to what comes out in the press, are for a just and equitable immigration reform. Unfortunately, what has happened is that the people, and they tend to be on the extreme right wing of our political spectrum, have done a good job in garnering press attention. But if poll after poll has shown that most Americans want an equitable immigration reform, and that's long overdue. And there are very common reasons for this. No one in the country is interested in driving on the highways with people who are not licensed to drive. If you're not licensed to drive, you don't get a vision check. But in many communities across the country, they've put restrictive measures on undocumented people having driver's licenses, for instance. No one is interested in living in a community where people don't have access to medical care. We all shop in the same stores. We would all be exposed to the same kinds of diseases. No one is interested in children not being educated. So people who actually live in the world know this. We see this. We now have a long, long period of time of interacting with people who are immigrants, especially from Mexico and Latin America. We've come to respect them for the values they bring to their community, and that does not reflect what comes out in the media.
You talked about the media there, and in fact, one of the comments that was made at this same conference was that there's a lot of poisoned polemic out there. Is it basically the case that the anti-immigration lobby is drowning out, as you say, the majority who are happy to have an immigration reform and to get this situation sorted out?
I think it's always easy to pick on weak people. It's a very easy news piece to talk about the terrorists coming across our southern border. Absolutely not true. It has everybody's attention immediately and serves as a tragic distraction from the real issues.
Is there also a fear amongst this, shall we say, very vocal minority, a fear of being swamped? I saw just the other day a survey that showed that within a generation, the ethnic minorities at present will become the majority of the population of the US. I mean, when you hear things like that, possibly, shall we say, the white Americans might become frightened.
That's the idea that the whites will become a minority in this country, those of Anglo-Saxon heritage. It is going to happen regardless of immigration. It's a demographic trend that's coming. In many reasons, because Caucasian families, white families, have stopped having children. It's way, way down. Immigrant families tend to be younger. In my own community, half the people here are under 22 years of age. So I think, yes, it's an easy thing to float out there and scare everybody else that we're disappearing. As a matter of fact, in the United States, in any case, it's one of our founding myths is that we're supposed to be a melting pot. And it's a thing that we're taught not to be afraid of. But again, I think that the news media and the more extreme members of right-wing political parties have seized on that very successfully, very effectively, to terrorize us. I think it's not a good argument. It's certainly not helpful.
You've been talking here about this anti-immigration rhetoric that's going on, but many people were shocked by a recent raid on a meatpacking plant in Iowa that detained nearly 400 illegal immigrants.
It's been in the news recently about this raid on this meatpacking place near Des Moines, Iowa. What's happened in the last recent months, this past year, is that the anti-immigrant legislation that did make it through Congress and is being passed in local states and communities are starting to bear fruit. So people say, yeah, we're against illegal immigration, but I don't think they realize the ramifications of that there would be roundups, that mothers literally breastfeeding their babies would be separated from these babies, that people who came up here on the promise of a wealthy Midwestern meat magnate, somebody's made a fortune, to do his dirty work in his job, ends up being chained like cattle, literally. It's an unbelievable thing. These poor, illiterate, most of them Guatemalan, chained at the ankles, at the waist, at their hands, paraded before the federal judge who basically said, admit you're guilty, because if you don't, we will hold you for 8 months in jail, and then you could probably go to jail for 2 to 10 years. Oh, so they all admit they're guilty. But one of the men doing the translation was so upset by what he said that he told what was going on, and he said they had no idea what the charges were against them. They signed because they were told to sign, most of them even being illiterate, and then they were sent to jail for fraud and identity theft. And then this man says, I didn't even understand the charges being brought against them. It was an absolute travesty of decency, if not justice, and again, perpetrated on the absolutely poorest, quietest people in the community and people who helped this company make a fortune out of their labor.
Many would say that, in fact, Americans have a very ambivalent attitude towards immigration because, as you say, on one hand, some of them may worry or complain about the influx of immigrants. But at the same time, as you say, they're also happy to take advantage of the cheaper labor costs that migrants represent.
Yes, absolutely. Americans are extraordinarily spoiled by the presence of undocumented people in the country. We have gardeners, we have maids, we have people who take care of our children at prices that you won't find anywhere else in the world that I can imagine, except in extremely poor third world countries, and that's only the very wealthy people. In the United States, a person in the middle class can hire someone to do their yard work or take care of their children at a fraction of the real value of the job. Now, the problem down the road is, if, in fact, a fair immigration reform comes in, what is the service industry then going to do? Who are they going to find that's going to work for $3 an hour? I think they're going to have a hard time. And I also suspect in my dark moments that that's what's behind a lot of this big business making big money on the backs of the poor and the people without a vote or without a voice.
high fence is currently being built along sections of the US border with Mexico in a bid to stem the flow of illegal immigrants crossing over to the US. Many people in Mexico and elsewhere have called the fence America's version of the Berlin Wall and were outraged at the move. Father Michaels says the fence that's been built is definitely not the solution to America's immigration problems, as claimed by its proponents.
The fence that's being constructed between the United States and Mexico, it actually is a wall. It's going to be in some places 18 feet tall, 10 feet across or wider so that the Border Patrol can ride across the top of it. It, to me, symbolizes the worst aspects of this whole immigration debate. Every political candidate from Obama to McCain talk about we have to secure our border before we can tackle immigration reform. But there's no way to secure a border this long and this porous, not with a wall, certainly not. It doesn't work. We had a congressional hearing here in Brownsville some months ago, and the chair of the House Intelligence Committee basically said the wall has been built in Arizona and it's already falling apart. It simply won't work. It's a fanciful invention to try and calm people living in Iowa or Indiana, people far from the border. The immigrants themselves, of course, well, Mexicans, it's an insult, it's an absolute insult to the Mexicans. People say that the only ones who are going to take advantage or who are going to win out over the wall are going to be the alien smugglers because they will rightfully be able to raise their prices much higher. I think the thing that most affects me about this border wall is that since 1994, when President Clinton began to a whole strategy of sealing the southern border, more than 5,000 people have died crossing into the United States because they're forced by the border security measures to go through the desert. And that's never addressed. That's never talked about. No one is accountable for the deaths of these people, who in the end are not terrorists. They're people looking to do work. They are the gardener, the cook, the child care worker. And I think that's an awful, awful reflection on our national leadership.
Staying in Texas, Cameron Park, a suburb of Brownsville, was described as the poorest suburb of the whole of the U.S., with terrible living conditions for illegal immigrants there. Can you describe some of these appalling conditions?
Cameron Park is a suburb of Brownsville. It is actually the place I live, where our parish here is. We have a per capita income of $4,135, according to the 2000 census, which is less than that of El Salvador, Guatemala, or Mexico. And put it into context, that is in the state of Texas, which is the 15th wealthiest entity in the world, produce more goods and money than Australia or Austria. So in this wealthy, wealthy place, we have these enormous pocket of poverty. We're 8,000 people. The four-county area that comprises the lower Rio Grande Valley, which is at the tip of Texas where Brownsville is, are the four poorest counties in the country. And the other thing is, again, because we're a young community, half of these very, very, very poor people are children. And the conditions continue to be appalling, especially with the downturn in the economic situation. We have no public hospital. Many of our children get very poor medical care. The schools continue to be overcrowded. The only really viable kinds of jobs are in the service industry, so that's going to keep us in this circle of poverty. We have families living 10 to 15 in three-bedroom homes. Again, it's an astonishing thing to see, considering that this is Texas, that you would have people forced to live in these kinds of conditions, and who I would add are American citizens in their most part. In this poorest part of the United States, easily 90% of the people here are residents, legal residents or American citizens, who were born, however, to Mexican immigrants.
One thing I wanted to discuss was Catholic attitudes towards immigration, because polls have shown that there are quite a consistent minority of Catholics that are anti-immigration, or at least fear the influx of immigrants into the US. Is enough being said within the church and by Catholic institutions to try to persuade these people that such attitudes are wrong?
The Catholic Church in the United States has done a marvelous piece of work on trying to educate people in the pews about the holiness of the immigrant in the Christian Jewish tradition. One of those pieces of scripture that really befuddles those right-wingers who take an anti-immigrant stance. You cannot deny what Jesus says in Matthew 25th chapter, treating the stranger as if he was I. So they've released several long teaching documents. They have teaching programs that have gone out to dioceses, into schools, into the Catholic universities. Those who have had access to them, I think, have been surprised and pleased by the posture of the church on this. Unfortunately, it's not something you can teach 5 minutes in a Mass on Sunday. And I think the other thing that's happened here that's sad, but I think it's one of these global human things, is that many, many, many Roman Catholics in the United States are from families who at one point in their lives were undocumented, were illegal aliens. My own hometown, Birmingham, Alabama, is a very small Catholic enclave. They were all Greek, Lebanese, and Italians, and Irish who worked the railroads and in the steel industry. And I go back home to talk with these guys, and it's striking to me how much they fear the immigrant. They fear they're going to lose the thing that they've worked so hard to get. But when I speak to them in terms of faith and trot out Matthew 25, to their credit, they think about it, and they are challenged by their faith. Again, I think this is when the immigrant becomes an opportunity for us to save ourselves from ourselves.
That was Father Michael Seifert from Brownsville, Texas. And you also heard the voice of Lupita Sanchez, a Mexican migrant. For most people, the word hospice is associated with pain and suffering, and above all, death. Many of us would not even relish the idea of stepping inside a place that cares for the terminally ill, as few like to dwell too closely on the uncomfortable truth of our own mortality. But as I've been finding out, a hospice nowadays is far from being a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony.
This is a place of much love and much laughter and much hope and much faith, and certainly not a place of doom and gloom.
Denise Mulligan is manager of St. Michael's Hospice in Hastings, England, and she believes it's high time to discard the typical doom and gloom image of a hospice. The commitment of Denise and the other staff to the patients at the hospice shines through when they speak, and she's quick to point out the rewards and privileges involved in their job.
I think here, those of us that work here and dearly love our hospice actually have learnt much from our patients, and we support them and they totally enrich our lives. I think when a person is actually nearing the end of their life, that we can actually learn much for the way that people actually live. And I think for us that work in palliative care, we learn something every day from the people that we care for.
With many people automatically equating terminal illnesses with dreadful physical pain, it's not surprising that many patients who first come to any hospice are worried about the agonies they believe must lie in store for them. Maxine Clist is manager of St. Augustine's Nursing Home, which is attached to St. Michael's Hospice. And she says they do everything possible to ensure that dying is pain-free in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. That is what we're here for. It's not just about their physical pain, it's about their emotional pain as well. And we aim through our multidisciplinary to achieve that for them in the way that they want. They're only going to die once. Our job is to make that as peaceful and as dignified for them as possible. And it's about them allowing them to die the way they want to do.
In addition to removing the pain, Maxine says their motto is to do everything within their power to make their patients' final days as happy as possible. And she told me sometimes they go to incredible lengths to try to satisfy their patients' wishes.
I had a patient who was a breeder of llamas, and her wish was to actually see her llamas before she died. And so we made every arrangement. We got drivers, we got horse boxers, and our only failing at the time was unfortunately due to the foot and mouth restrictions. We weren't able to actually get the llama down. We tried everything possible, and that was enough for her. She knew that we weren't giving up on her wishes.
Even without pain, death is a frightening prospect for most of us. So how much of a comfort is it to have a strong faith in God? The Reverend Robert Langdon is the resident chaplain at St. Michael's Hospice.
Well, my experience is that where people have a faith, it is enormously strengthening and comforting for them. But a large number of people don't have a faith, and that's where we come in. We're there for them. We seek to offer a ministry of love, compassion, sympathy and hope. And of course, in a large hospice, such gifts are constantly needed.
He says often the real challenge is persuading people to come to terms with and accept the fact that death is inevitable for all of us.
Anthony was a depressed and agitated man, kept asking, what's it all about? What's the purpose of it all? Why? But a gentle, caring ministry of our whole team, in the end, brought about a peace and a calm and an acceptance. And I noticed that anxiety and fear disappeared from his face during those last days, and he died a peaceful death.
Maxine says emotional pain is sometimes the toughest nut of all to crack when trying to help people come to terms with their own mortality.
We've had some very tough cases. Probably the hardest ones are the ones with emotional pain. I had a gentleman who was a squadron leader in the Second World War, and he saw his whole squadron of young men burnt to death on a raid. And this haunted him all the way through his life. And this came back to him time and time again as a dream. He would be climbing steps, and when the door opened, there would be a big, large fire there that he had to step into. And this was representing what his death was going to be for him. With very, very gentle work through all members of the team, we helped him to come to terms. And I got a call in the middle of the night. And I came in and I went into his room. And his face was just so different. And he then described to me the dream that he had had that night. He climbed up the stairs and he opened the door. And instead of there being fire there, there was a big, beautiful blue sky. And he now knew that death was something that was going to be peaceful and it wasn't going to hurt. And in actual fact, Ian died 2 days afterwards, taking no more painkillers than paracetamol, because his emotional pain had gone now.
But is it tough for them emotionally, looking after people who they know are destined not to be around for much longer? Maxine again.
It can be, but as a team, we work together as a team. We all recognise that there's going to be a patient that's going to push a button in us more than anyone else. And so as a team, we rally together, we support each other. But it's not all darkness, because we have those patients alongside the ones who have got problems who are playing rock and roll music to 4 in the morning, you know, celebrating their life. And so we're part of that. So there is this balance going on all the time with happiness and sadness. But at the end of the day, if our patients have died peacefully, with dignity and with acceptance, then the stress isn't there because we've done our bit.
Do you consider that those are the rewards of your job, or are there other ones as well?
I think the reward for me is knowing that a patient has died, accepting that death is there, that they are embracing it, that they are pain-free, they're symptom-free, and more importantly, that the family are there as well, that they have accepted that this is going to happen, that we can't change the inevitable. Yes, there will be sadness, but if we can help reduce that for them by a degree of acceptance and through lots and lots of love in our community, that's where my satisfaction comes from.
That was Maxine Clist, and you also heard the voices of the Reverend Robert Langdon and Denise Mulligan, all from St. Augustine's Hospice in Hastings, England. That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.